and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're learning about space travel and planetary colonization. Charles Woolforth discusses his new book, Beyond Earth, and answers questions about humanity and its potential for reaching new worlds. This event took place on February 3rd of 2017 at the Hilton Hotel and was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Deborah Smith, chair of the board of directors for the Alaska World Affairs Council, starts things off.
Well, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to introduce our speaker today, Charles Woolforth. Mr. Woolforth is a lifelong Alaskan and a prize-winning author of more than 10 books. His books have included The Whale and the Supercomputer on the Northern Front of Climate Change, which won a Los Angeles Times Book Prize in 2004, and also The Fate of Nature, Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. He also writes about politics and history, travel, and has also written as told to biographies. He writes a frequent column in the Alaska Dispatch News, which you no doubt see, and he regularly hosts interview programs on the Alaska Public Media radio stations. I'm sure his voice will be very familiar to you, hearing him on Hometown Alaska and The Outdoor Explorer. He's lectured all over the United States and overseas, and we're very pleased he's made the time to be with us here today. Mr. Woolforth graduated magna cum laude from Princeton University in 1986, so all you students should study hard. Before returning to Alaska to work 6 years as a newspaper reporter, he then became a full-time freelance writer in 1993, publishing articles in The New Republic, the magazine Outside, Discover, and other periodicals. He served 2 3-year terms on the Anchorage Assembly and has worked as a political consultant and speechwriter and led various community groups, including a nonprofit organization that brought hundreds of millions of dollars of new support to struggling rural Alaska schools. So one of our most important questions for him may be, when does he sleep? His latest book, Beyond Earth, which is co-authored with Amanda Hendricks, is grounded not only in the human capacity for invention and the appeal of adventure, but also reflects on the bureaucratic, political, and scientific realities that present obstacles to space travel. The book has been very well received. You may have seen it on the front table of the Barnes & Noble through the Christmas season, or read its excellent review in the Wall Street Journal. He's here today to speak to us on Beyond Earth, International Cooperation and Competition in Space. Please join me in welcoming him to the podium.
Thank you for that great introduction. I was trying not to get a swelled head, but I'm not sure if I succeeded. I love the World Affairs Council. It's a terrific organization. And my favorite event is the World Whiz Trivia Contest, which is held annually at the Taproot nightclub. And my first experience of it was 2014. I was out with some friends, and somebody said, hey, this is going on, let's go over there. So we went over, pulled together a team at the last minute, and our team was called Liquid Intelligence. We didn't take it too seriously. We did definitely imbibe. And then one of the categories came up. It was World Assassins. And I can't explain how, but I killed it. I got 10 out of 10 World Assassins, and we won the contest. My friends have never looked at me the same since. You know, I don't know why I know all the World Assassins. So anyway, we went back again in 2016. We got ringers. We had an international law expert on our team. We got crushed. So I think the first strategy was the better strategy. So today I'm going to talk about my book, Beyond Earth, which is came out in November from Pantheon. And I'm going to do a different talk than I often do. And I'm going to be speaking again at the Eagle River Nature Center next week to their annual meeting, where I'm going to talk more about the science aspects of it and the planetary discoveries that have taken place that are covered. And today I'm going to talk more about the issue of space colonization and the idea that human beings could go into space, and how would that happen, you know, go into space to live permanently. How would that happen? Where would it happen? And why would it happen in relation to international relations and the way that we are building rockets these days? And me and my co-author, Amanda Hendricks. Amanda is a senior scientist who works in the planetary science field and is one of the main investigators on the Cassini probe, which is currently circling Saturn, and has worked in a lot of other really important outer space projects. I'm so sorry, this table over here probably can't see the screen at all. I don't know if they could distribute somewhere else in the room so they can see. The elementary school kids are kind of blocked out. Amanda is quite the optimist, and she also has great contacts. So she was able to get me into JPL and Johnson Space Center and the SpaceX assembly plant in LA and Virgin Galactic, where they're building their spacecraft. And that was a great part of the experience. So she's the technology optimist, and I'm the technology pessimist. There's no way I'm going anywhere in a rocket, right? I can hardly sit still to fly to Seattle on a 737. I'm not going to sit, for months on a rocket. I'm not going to live on another planet if I can't ski. So we have a very different perspective, and that fed into the book, the optimistic, the technology-oriented perspective, and my what I would think may be the more realistic perspective. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about before I get into the sort of the international questions is what is the plausibility that people ever will move into space, right? I think if you think about it, we kind of assume it from science fiction, but there's some problems with some of our assumptions. This is a model that was created in the early 1970s by NASA when they expected to be creating real space colonies fairly soon, and that was a really long time ago. I don't know why it advanced by itself. So this was a structure that was supposed to hold 10,000 people in orbit around the Earth, and they actually did do preliminary design on it. And one of the problems is you'd be bombarded with space radiation. And in terms of would you really have a colony if everything you've got comes from the Earth below, or would it really just be an floating outpost? The way we define colony is not just going somewhere and saying you've been, but that you can go out there, you could live there, there'd be a reason to do it, you'd be self-supporting, and you could stay permanently. So this to us is really not a colony, and it seems very pretty unlikely that you would really do it if you think about how much money it would cost to put it up there. This is another thing that was actually designed by NASA scientists. These are balloons in the atmosphere of Venus, and this would protect you from radiation from space. You could actually do it and stay there, but again, it doesn't meet our other qualifications for a colony because you don't have any way to harvest resources if you're sitting in a balloon. And you don't really have an opportunity to increase the size of your colony, right? If you're going to increase the size of your colony, you've got to get another balloon. This is kind of a familiar image of what we think of as a colony. This is actually a model that was designed for the moon. The moon has these lava tubes, and you could actually live down there and be protected from radiation. Same thing on Mars. You can't live on the surface because of radiation, but you could live underground. Our sense about that was that doesn't sound much like something people would ever want to do, right? I mean, why would you go there and live underground? How impractical would it be to build a huge underground city, right? And if you're worried about environmental problems and that's why you're leaving, well, you could live underground on the Earth. I mean, one of the things I thought about is would it be easier to go to this new place or to just live go to Antarctica or something? And I think the moon and Mars, we kind of came to the conclusion that living underground is not something that people are probably going to want to do. So we kept looking, and we decided we need a place that fits us better ecologically, a place that's more like the Earth, and we found it out in the outer solar system. There's a moon of Titan, a moon of Saturn called Titan, which has a nitrogen atmosphere that'll protect you from radiation. It's quite cold, but you don't need a space suit, you don't need a pressure suit, because the pressure is really similar to what it is here. And interestingly, the surface looks a lot like Earth's. It has the only liquid bodies in the solar system which looks just like lakes. They have waves, they have tides. It rains on Titan. But there's no, it's not liquid water, it's liquid methane. So those are lakes of essentially liquefied natural gas. The surface of the planet, instead of rock, is ice. So you have an unlimited supply of oxygen in the ice. And you would actually be able to build a colony there, live, expand. You'd have all the resources you'd need. So that's what we focused on in the book. And the question then becomes, okay, we could get there. If we could get there, we can't now. It's too far away. It takes 7 years to get there. But assuming we advance our technology and we can get there, what would get us there? What would take us? And what are the drivers behind human colonization? Well, I mean, we know that humans have done some pretty amazing colonization in the past, so it's not far-fetched to think that we want to spread beyond this planet. We looked at a lot of past colonies on Earth to look for some lessons in history. And of course, as Americans, we all know about the colonists who came from England and lived on our East Coast, the Plymouth Colony and the Jamestown Colony, and they're all part of our national mythology. We also spent a lot of time studying the lost colony of Roanoke Island, which was the very first colony from England, sent by Sir Walter Raleigh, which failed. And everyone disappeared or died. And why? Well, the resupply was supposed to take place when the Spanish Armada attacked in England. And the Queen wasn't going to let ships go to resupply a colony in America when England was fighting for its life. Kind of brings up the point, you know, if we had a colony in space and we got them into a world war, would the president, you know, divert billions and billions of dollars to resupply a colony on Mars? Maybe not, right? So any colony you build has got to be in some way self-sufficient if it's going to be sustainable. You know, some colonists in our history have done things much more amazing than the English. If you think about the Pacific Islanders voyaging from Asia to colonize the islands of the Pacific, they took off in these little boats, and they had no idea where they were going, right? They didn't even know if there was an island out there. I mean, the courage of that achievement is extraordinary. We know a lot more about the planets that we'd be going to, and actually the trip would probably be significantly safer than the trip that these folks took. In terms of hardship, we can think about the colonization of Alaska. And I'm not talking about the Klondike Gold Rush, but the indigenous people who came here, you know, perhaps 30,000 years ago. Think about what it was like for them to trek across this frigid landscape. What they needed to do was invent technology that would protect them, right? So they needed to invent boats, and they needed to invent clothing that would keep them warm for that kind of trek. It's very similar to what we need to do in order to colonize another planet. The housing that they built was extraordinary. You know, the sod igloos of Alaska were warm enough, were well enough insulated inside that you could heat that enclosure with a seal oil lamp warmly enough that people didn't have to wear clothing when they were inside. And you know how cold Arctic Alaska is. So an extraordinary technological achievement. And if you think about, like, how hard was it to build those houses compared to how hard it is for us to build a rocket? Well, they didn't have any steel, right? They were digging frozen permafrost ground with stone and bone tools. I would suggest that for a family to do that is really hard. On top of that, if you look at the rafters, they're made of whalebone. So these were people who would go out on the sea ice and using, tools that they could make out of bone and skin would harvest a 20-ton whale, drag it perhaps 10 miles across the ice, all that material, and use it in their housing. I don't think that's any easier or any easier than building a rocket. So, and of course, people still live in the Arctic and still pursue a lot of those ways. So, in our country, you know, we spread out across the West, and what were we looking for? A lot of our colonization, the drive was to get away from crowding and look for economic opportunity. And that was probably true of the Inupiaq people and the other people of the Arctic as well, that they were looking for new places to live. This is a sort of colonization we might think of in Alaska. But if you look back at history, really the sort of the pioneers who were just picking around with a pick and shovel didn't really accomplish that much. This is what colonization really looks like when it's successful. This is a diamond mine in Yakutia. It's said to be the biggest hole in the world. And so colonization, to really work, it has to have a financial goal, right? Or something, so there, you need a reason to do it for it to happen in the big time. In the United States, it also needed what we like to call public-private partnership. So the railroads that crossed our country had huge subsidies from the government, but then were built by private industry, and the private industry was able to pocket the profits. And that's how we were able to colonize the American West so rapidly. And in Alaska, of course, the Alaska Railroad was built entirely by the government for a price, a prodigious price, which is on the order of a moonshot. In other words, it was the $72 million that was spent on the Alaska Railroad. At the time, the whole federal budget was $750 million. So pushing towards 10% of the federal budget, it was a huge, huge expedition. And why was it done? Well, for political reasons. Did it pay itself back? No, not really. It's never been a financial success particularly, but we got the Alaska colony out of it. So that's maybe the most probable model for space colonization is major major government investment that provides opportunity for profit and competition for private parties. So that's it for the slides, but I want to take that idea a little farther. So for a colony, you need some kind of natural resources or some kind of goal that you're going for. That could be a lack of natural resources where you're coming from. You could be trying to get away from somewhere, or it could be something of value that you're pursuing. You're going to need private ingenuity, profit, and some courage to do it. And then you're also going to need some kind of public investment, some kind of partnership that's going to allow you to carry this forward. If you think about models that are similar to space on Earth, there are not too many of them because, you know, in every case of pretty much every case of colonization on Earth, there were people already there, right? And so colonization tended to be displacement and theft. There is an example that's not that, though, which is Antarctica. And it's interesting how, you know, the regime for Antarctica has developed through international treaty and cooperation. And it's not, Antarctica is not part of any nation. Called terra nullius, which is the idea of that there's nobody there. It's a nobody's land before you get there. So in 1967, there was a treaty adopted, the Outer Space Treaty, under the auspices of the United Nations, and it essentially takes the same sort of idea as Antarctica. And one of its terms is, to quote, outer space, including the moon and the other celestial bodies, is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use of occupation, or any other means. And so essentially, that really takes away the profit motive, right, of going out and grabbing an asteroid or something like that, because those resources can never be owned under that treaty. Whether that treaty would really remain in force if there was great profit and competition to go into space, I'm not sure. And if private parties, some of the billionaires who are building spacecraft now, found a profit-making opportunity to go into space and seize the moon or seize a planet and say it was theirs, I'm not sure who would be around to stop them. So I'm not sure if an international treaty would really have any effect in that situation. In any event, we have a pretty strong example of international cooperation in space, which is the International Space Station. Let me just read you a short excerpt about it from the book. The space station is NASA's one major accomplishment in human spaceflight since the shuttle. Building it in orbit became the sole purpose of the shuttle. Conceived during Ronald Reagan's administration, the station's purpose also evolved. After the fall of the Soviet Union, it became the International Space Station, the ISS, and one of its major goals was to bring nations together in a shared project. When NASA retired the shuttle, only the Russians had the ability to get people to the station. Today, all NASA astronauts take intensive courses in Russian. But well before Russia invaded Ukraine, it was clear that politics would be the dog wagging the space station tail, not the other way around. Operationally, the crews had already segregated, with the Americans and Russians sticking to their own areas at opposite ends of the station and doing their own work with limited interaction. In the 2009 Augustine report, this was a federal commission that looked at NASA, which influenced Obama to cancel President Bush's Constellation program, called for extending the life of the ISS. After 25 years of planning and construction and $100 billion in cost, the original plan to crash into the ocean after only 5 years didn't make much sense. The purpose of the station had become to learn about human spaceflight to enable long-range exploration. So what we've been doing, you know, up to now is building spacecraft, the purpose of which is to build the next spacecraft and take us further out. And we haven't really figured out where we're going or what the purpose of you know, what the ultimate purpose is. The international cooperation of the space station really has to a large extent, collapsed. The progress that's happening now is happening in private industry, and it's happening pretty rapidly. In all of these examples, there's some competitive opportunity to make money. So we visited Virgin Galactic. This is Richard Branson's project. He's trying to build essentially a space plane that will take you up out of the atmosphere, essentially for a short time, weightless, and then bring you back down reusably. And pretty close to it, although they had a test flight accident. But he sold many tickets at $250,000 a piece just for a joyride. So there's a tourism market there. The bigger market, though, is once they're able to do this, they'll have essentially an aircraft that can go above the atmosphere and fly to other parts of the world, so that you could have a businessman in New York go to, you know, to Shanghai for a meeting on a 90-minute flight, and then come back. You could have one-day meetings on the absolute other side of the world, which is something that, as you think about it, you think, gee, I think I'd like to invest in that, right? You know, think about going to the East Coast and getting there in half an hour. So that's something that's going to happen. And how it rolls out, if Branson's the first to do it, I don't know. But I predict that will happen, and that will be a flow of a lot of money coming into space, into the space industry. Another one you've heard about is Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon. His space company is called Blue Origin. He was the first to land the first stage of a rocket. Why is this important? Well, what we've been doing until then is similar to the idea of like loading up a 747, you know, flying it from New York to Paris, and then demolishing it and building another one to fly back. You know, that's been our model, the NASA model, since the beginning of the space age. Well, the cost of every launch is that those stages that are being discarded. The fuel on a rocket going into orbit is about the same cost as the fuel of a 747 flying, you know, coast to coast. So if you can save the rocket, you've just taken zeros off the cost. Bezos is now building a big rocket, a heavy lift rocket, with we'll have up to 70-ton metric ton payload. Elon Musk's SpaceX is also building a heavy lift rocket, which is should be able to launch soon. At least he's pretty much farther along than Bezos, and has a payload that is equivalent to a fully loaded 737, the plane and the cargo. So it can carry a lot. We visited SpaceX, and we saw how they are building rockets there, and it's amazing. They're doing the whole thing in one room. They buy everything off the shelf they can. So NASA creates these special purpose computers and really, really gets them perfect so that they'll never fail. And SpaceX had the idea, like, well, let's just buy some computers, you know, from off the shelf, but we'll just put, like, multiple computers on. If one of them fails, there'll be another one. So massive cost savings. We went to JPL and talked with some engineers about how they're building another Mars rover, and talked to this really brilliant young engineer. And I said, you know, have you ever built anything that went into space? And he said, well, there was this spring inside the arm on the Curiosity rover. And I said, well, how long did it take? And he said, well, you know, from beginning to end, it took me about 7 years. Then we went to SpaceX in Hawthorne, and this young lady was just out of school. She was the first job she'd worked out of engineering school. She was in charge of the second stage of the rocket, design, fabrication, testing, and launch. And she was having a great time. And I said, like, how long does it take you? I said the same question. Do you ever have anything you designed been in space? She's like, looks at me like crazy. Well, yeah, the rocket. And so I said, well, how long does it take you to implement a design change? She said, well, you know, if I have an idea, I talk to the design guys. They're over here on computers. They print it out on the 3D printer, and we screw it on the rocket, and we document it. So one day. And that is how they're building rockets that are making it to space and innovating incredibly fast and getting the price down. So NASA was paying $400 million for a launch of this size of rocket. You can buy one. You can go right on the website, $61 million, including insurance through SpaceX. And their heavy lift rocket will be launching for $100 million. Bezos should be able to do it for about the same. That will be a factor of 10 reduction for the same rocket through NASA and through the commercial space industry that was federally supported. Meanwhile, NASA really hasn't gotten the memo. They're still building the Space Launch System, which is expected to have its first test flight in 2018. The cost of that rocket will be $13 billion, and it will cost $3 billion per launch. So it's just like, you know, NASA invented the technology, but implementing it is just done much better by these competitive companies that see a way to make a lot of money. And once they get their technology certified, they will make a lot of money because whole new things that we can't do now can be done if you can get into space that quickly and that cheaply. So we're also going to see competition from other countries. India, you probably read, launched a Mars orbiter. They did it for $74 million, all in. Incidentally, the budget for the movie The Martian was $108 million, right? So, you know, the science payload of India's orbiter is not that impressive. You know, what NASA is doing with planetary science is way better, but at that kind of price point, and with their capabilities, you know, there's some competition there that will be coming up. You know, China is going to the moon, and most experts believe that the moon is the next place we should be going for human spaceflight. Not Mars. We're really not ready for Mars. We can go to the moon. We can harvest water there. We can create fuel there. We can learn how to live on another planet just three days away. And we can use that as a base to get to Mars and to get to a lot of other places. They've been extremely successful technically. They've made their goals. They will be landing later this year, landing a rover on the moon that will bring back a sample to Earth. Their first manned mission into space was 2003, and their goal is to be on the moon in the 2030s. And if you look at what their statements, they're explicitly thinking about how to commercialize this. How do they build the technology and sell the technology and build the capability to go to the moon and make money from that? So the U.S. remains, you know, preeminent in space, but NASA is definitely in danger of losing the competition. I told you the story about the spring. The other factor is that we just don't spend that much money on it anymore compared to what we did. You know, in the Cold War, we were driven to go to the moon by competition with Russia, and it was actually a way we were going to win the Cold War. It is a way we did win the Cold War. To do that, we spent 4.4% of gross domestic product on space through the mid-1960s. Enormous amount of money. We're now spending around 0.5%. So the equivalent budget, you know, the inflation-adjusted budget for NASA in 1966 was $43 billion. You can't do what you could do for an eighth or a tenth of the money as you could do then. And then there's the culture of NASA, which is a big problem. In that same 2009 Augustine report that I mentioned, there's a quote that was sent in by a member of the public by email. It said, I'm a young aerospace engineer, master's candidate. My classmates' options are working for monolithic bureaucracies where their creativity will be crushed by program cancellations, cost overruns, and risk aversion. It is no surprise that many of them choose to work in finance. So the rewards were not there in 2009. Now they can go work for SpaceX. So that's a much more exciting thing for a young person to do. So I guess the question is, like, maybe this future competition will be between China and between our U.S. companies, because our U.S. companies are building stuff that nobody else can build. So what are the key questions we need to think about in order to sort of envision this future and what it could look like? What do we want to be driven by? Do we want to have another Cold War to drive us forward? You know, of course not. That was a terrible time of fear and waste. Is there a way to invest and create that competition around a positive vision of where we could go in space? Do we want to be running towards something, or do we want to be running away from something? A lot of people who talk about space now talk about it in terms of Elon Musk, who says, we've got to be on Mars because our species may go extinct because of environmental concerns or international security concerns. Stephen Hawking made a similar prediction, you know, that if we don't get off this planet, we'll be gone in 1,000 years. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's kind of a question for our species about, you know, how are we going to do this? If you think about, you know, climate change as being a driver, suppose we're unable to cooperate on Earth to the extent we need to do to deal with climate change, and we destroy our planet, right? Will we then be able to cooperate in order well enough to get off the planet? And how many will be able to go? You know, so these are kinds of the big questions that actually these guys are investing billions of dollars are thinking about. It's, you know, that cooperation competition thing goes for climate change as well as for space exploration. So I like to think about what could be the goal that we're pursuing. You know, maybe it's the spirit of exploration and the spirit of expansion that similar to those Polynesians or those indigenous people who came to Alaska and the courage and drive that they had. So to conclude, let me just read you the last couple of paragraphs of the book. Incidentally, when I'm done, I'll just scoot back there and I'd be happy to sign copies and take your questions. When would humans go and why? We hope it is not because the Earth has become a scary place. Saving the Earth is infinitely safer and saner than preparing to leave it. Alternative energy is cheap compared to spaceflight. The technology to reduce carbon is simple compared to building a rocket. And Earth is a paradise compared to anywhere we might go. Besides, no significant percentage of Earth's population will ever move to another planet or moon. We would be building an ark, not a lifeboat. Our moment in history is a balancing point. We could tip toward a world of environmental collapse and conflict, or commit to our shared planet and aspirations for accomplishments that make us proud of our humanity. Dreams of space and hopes for a stable environment have this in common. They both call on the better part of ourselves for our cooperation and commitment to something we can only do together. Both call on the intellect for invention and the heart for courage to create good new things and to sacrifice for the benefit of a better world. That is our hope for a healthy world that sends colonists to Titan, not with fear, but with optimism. So thank you. I'll take your questions.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing about space travel and the colonization of other planets based on the new book, Beyond Earth. This conversation was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel on February 3rd. We go now to Lisa Falsko as she leads us into questions from the audience.
If you have any questions, please raise your hand and please wait for the microphone because this is being recorded for the radio. Thank you.
Yeah, and questions on anything you like. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sarah Feinstein from Eagle River. And I was wondering, how do you believe the regulation could negatively impact, or how do you believe that it negatively impacts NASA, and how do you think that it positively impacts NASA?
Regulation?
Yes.
I think caution and risk aversion are really the problems that are affecting NASA, and the fact that as a nation we don't seem to be able to choose a goal that we want NASA to pursue and stick with it. So each president comes in and changes the goal, and then a ton of money is invested in that, and then new administration, they change the goal. That's happened over and over and over again. There are certainly those in NASA who think that if they could waive some of the risk regulations, so they have regulations that govern what percent of probability of you know, cancer risk or other failure they can accept. They'd like to sort of increase those, but they're not sort of this sort of regulation that industry has. They're more of an internal regulation. So it's a very bureaucratic organization. It's an organization that really has trouble choosing goals and sticking with them, and it's got a problem, which I think is a national problem of risk aversion, that if something goes wrong, there's a lot more punishment than there is reward for something going right, and that creates a situation where people don't want to try anything.
So one of the things that the international community has never really addressed is how private property rights and national territory will be defined in space. Yet I'm inclined to believe that that will become a very important issue in the next century when private companies start staking claims to asteroids or nations staking claim to extraterrestrial land. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. Do you think the UN will have to get involved in space definitions? And if national territory is allowed extraterrestrially, is there any hope of preventing space militarization?
We address that pretty extensively in the book. The way the book is structured is we have a section that has this current technology and talks about what's happening now, and then we have a section about a future scenario that tries to take the situation that we have now projected in the future. And the future we think is most likely is that this public-private partnership concept will go forward, and some of these very rich individuals will be driving a lot of that. And it's improbable to us that they would, you know, get to another planet such as Titan, the moon of Saturn, and wouldn't stake claim to property there. And I don't know who would stop them, right? Once you're out there, you're kind of outside the boundaries of the Earth legal system. If you don't want to pay attention to it, you don't. And if there is competition there, I'm sure it will be militarized, because until there is a new international system created for that planet, it'll be the survival of the fittest and the strongest. So I think the 1967 treaty is a wonderful idea. But one of the things we started thinking about is, like, once you actually have colonists going, are they going to agree to live in what is essentially a completely communistic society, where the government gets to decide everything? I mean, that's sort of like, you know, people who are, you know, living in Antarctica, they're all on a salary from somebody, right? But if they're living there on their own, are they still going to want to do everything according to, you know, what they're told to do? I don't think they would, especially if they're investing billions of dollars to get there. So then, I mean, you're kind of in a situation that's a Wild West until something is resolved in that context.
My name is Earl, and I go to Tudor Elementary. And why is it that we can't colonize on Antarctica? Has the research led to that question?
Why can't we colonize Antarctica? Well, that's a great question. I'm not an expert on Antarctica, and it could have developed that way. But what happened was that the people who initially were going to Antarctica were scientists, and it developed in more of a scientific sort of the goals of going to Antarctica were scientific, and in that world of science, international agreements were made not to exploit Antarctica for profit, and that has held. And now the way nations compete in Antarctica is through their scientific endeavor there. I actually think a lot more science takes place in Antarctica than would be justified for science sake. Because of the questions of national prestige and the desire to stake a claim there. There are some pretty valuable resources in Antarctica, so I don't know if that regime always hold, but that's sort of been the way it has developed through tradition. Great question, by the way.
My name is Race, and I'm from Tudor Elementary, and I was wondering, how are we going to get enough resources to build the space the spacecraft if we have to go from Earth, and how are we gonna get there and have enough resources to actually survive?
Right, that's another great question. So it's a major challenge, twofold. One is propellant for your rocket. We really don't know how to build a rocket, even to get you to Mars in a time frame when you won't be severely affected by space radiation, because of the chemical propellant needed in the rocket. So we need new propulsion systems that can work electronically, can use a nuclear reactor to use different kinds of propellants that will get you farther faster. The other problem, frankly, is the food storage problem. NASA, it really doesn't have a food storage system that would get you to Mars and back at this point. I think it's within sort of stretch technology that they can develop that. But with the super compact astronaut food that we have, you need like the quantity you need to get to Mars and back is like multiple truckloads. I mean, it's quite a bit of food. And the shelf life is a serious problem in that radiation environment and the space environment. Most of the food that we have that we use in space won't last long enough. To get farther out into space to another planet, no way. We just simply don't have the technology to carry that much food. I mean, if you've done a backpacking trip, you know, even your and remember, you're not carrying water. Even your freeze-dried food gets pretty bulky for a long trip. Now imagine, like, for a year? Forget about it, right? So the other thing that NASA's found, and I really enjoyed the chapter that we wrote about food, is that it's not enough just to have sustenance. You know, science fiction, you're always like, just take a pill or eat some green stuff. What we found on the space station and all kinds of other experiments is if the food doesn't taste good and if it isn't culturally relevant to you, you will lose weight and lose health. So we are totally creatures of our culture, and we will not thrive health-wise unless we like our food, if we can eat it in a sort of a social setting, and it's culturally relevant to us. So it's not enough just to come up with a pill. You've got to have like food that people want to eat.
My name is Will Brandel. I go to Eagle River High School. I was wondering, under what circumstances would people be willing to go to the moon on Mars?
Well, in terms of individuals, there's lots of people who will go. And a few years ago, there was this guy in, I think, the Netherlands, who came out and said, you know, I'm starting a colony on the moon, on Mars. And my reading of it was that it is a scam, right? He didn't have any money, and he said, well, we're going to fund it through reality TV or something. He got like 100, you know, I don't remember the exact number, but something like 100,000 or more than 100,000 people who signed up and say, yeah, I'll go. And even though it was essentially a one-way trip, there's no way to get them back, you know. So there's lots, out of our 7 billion people, there's lots of people who are ready to go, even if it's sort of an ill-thought-out thing. So the bigger question, probably what you're asking, is like if who is going to invest a huge part of our national treasure to go and actually create a self-sustaining colony? I mean, my sense is that people don't usually do that unless they think that there's something they're going to get out of it. Either they think there's going to be great opportunity for them from being out there, that there's going to be a resource there that they want to bring back that's of great value, or that life here is so terrible that they have to go. So, like, you know, and that would be sort of the pilgrims, right? They had a religious oppression in England and in Europe, and so they came and started a new colony. So that's the getting away from version. Some of the other, you know, the people going west were, you know, immigrants who were in the East Coast cities and they had no economic opportunities, crowded, lack of resources, so they were going. So those would be some different reasons why people would go.
Hi, I'm Kate Paskovich from Eagle River High School. And I was wondering if you knew anything about the side effects physically and mentally about living in space and how the healthcare system would have to evolve to accommodate that.
Yeah, we spent a great deal of time researching that because it's really the biggest barrier for going to Mars. And we think it's pretty much, at this point, we need some major technology leaps to get beyond the moon and get to Mars. And we wrote a an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times that was picked up all over the world on that topic. So there's various barriers. One is the health effects of weightlessness. Fairly recent discovery is that weightlessness interferes with the circulation of the cerebral fluid in your brain and causes excessive pressure in your optic nerve. And we don't know how long, but eventually you'd go blind and have dementia side effects from that. So you need to have some gravity. We're not made to be weightless permanently. Even bigger problem is space radiation. These are what are called galactic cosmic rays, which are highly energetic particles. We now know that they are very cancer-causing. The risk of pretty severe cancers for someone who traveled with our current technology to Mars and back would be unacceptable. And even more recently, we've found out that these particles can actually cause brain damage short of cancer. So in experiments where they've bombarded mice with these particles, they found that they have severe cognitive losses from being in these particles. And so the NASA has got a pretty serious risk that they've started to study, which is that the astronauts would simply, their brains would be too severely damaged to command the spacecraft. And that's, again, potentially on the time span it would take to get to Mars and back. And there's really no way to shield against those. They're huge particles, and to shield against them, you would need meters of water, which is too heavy. So we're not ready to go to Mars. In terms of the solutions to these, obviously getting more material into space for shielding would be one solution. We think the best solution is just to build much faster spacecraft so that you can get through the dangers of space and to your destination before you have the health effects.
Hi, my name is Carl Lehman, and I'm also with Eagle River High School. And I was wondering, under the Obama administration, many programs of NASA were defunded due to cost. I was wondering if NASA were to adopt some of these cost-reducing actions taken by the private companies you mentioned, whether or not our government would be interested in possibly reinvesting in space exploration.
Right. So what happened, and it's happened repeatedly since the Reagan administration, is that the presidents have come in and have sort of declared big goals for NASA, but they haven't increased funding. So NASA funding has been pretty flat. It hasn't really gone down, sort of inflation eroded, but it's been pretty much flat for a really long time. And when President Obama came in, he appointed a commission which studied the plans that were already in place from President Bush, which was for a Mars mission. And the commission said, like, at the amount of money you're spending, you're never going to get to Mars. You know, it's like, and so President Obama, I don't think there was any interest in spending that much money. I think we'd probably be talking about $1 trillion to get to Mars. And so he canceled that, and he came up with this other idea of capturing an asteroid and bring it to the moon, and nobody's very enthusiastic about that. So really, NASA does not have a goal now. I think the second part of your question is totally on the money. They need to cancel, they need to stop building their own hardware and focus. Our conclusion in the book is they need to focus on these stretch goals, the things that the faster propulsion, the health issues, the things that private sector is never going to do because there's no way to make money from them. They're too far out. And the technology that's already been developed, which the private sector is moving forward much more rapidly and much less cost, let them do it. But you know, the problem, it's in the military as well as NASA, there's this problem of the government wanting to continue to support the contractors that it has cozy relationships with. So, you know, even though SpaceX could undercut the cost of a military launch by, you know, maybe an order of magnitude, the Air Force came up with some certification process that took years for them to get through before they would be able to use SpaceX so they could continue to use Lockheed Martin and these other contractors. So it's part of this, you know, this thing that goes back and forth between government and certain contractors that needs to be broken through to actually start saving the money that's available to be saved. Are we out of time? Can we take one more question? All right.
Hello, my name's Joseph Music, and I'm from Eagle River High School. I was wondering how feasible it would be to use solar sails and or cryogenesis to get people further out in space, such as to get to Titan.
Well, something like a solar sail that gives you high-speed propulsion without having to carry all the propellant on board, I think is necessary. There's various ideas. There's even one idea we wrote about in the book, which is to use quantum virtual particles that just appear in space and use those as the propellant and use a nuclear reactor or solar power to accelerate them so that you can have constant acceleration. Any kind of constant acceleration is going to get you faster than a chemical rocket, because you know the idea of a chemical rocket is you get a short burn and then you coast at the same speed till your destination. If you can continue to accelerate, even if only very, very slightly throughout the trip, you're going to get there much, much faster. I think the cryogenic thing is science fiction at this point. I don't think there's anybody really studying that idea. And I think that you could probably run into the same problem of space radiation that you would run into if you're awake. So if your body is out in space for years, then you're being bombarded by this radiation, then the damage is going to take place whether you're asleep or awake, right? So I think that's a great, I really enjoyed that movie Passengers. I thought it was really fun. But I don't think that's how it's going to work. I don't see a way around, unless you could do some kind of electronic shielding or some kind of shielding that we haven't thought of to keep you safe from the radiation.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing from Charles Woolforth as he discusses the possibility of humanity achieving long-distance space travel and planetary colonization as discussed in his new book, Beyond Earth. He was speaking at the Hilton Hotel on February 3rd of 2017 at an event sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council. I'm your host and producer for this program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.